We're talking about the ongoing work to address the climate crisis in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Our state's first clean energy plan was published in April. The governor's climate change task force published its final report at the end of 2020. We look at what's next for people who continue this work on multiple climate policy fronts. Join in on environmental strategies you want to prioritize that will help Wisconsin for generations to come. What you want to know about this committee work, 800-642-1234. Stephanie Salgado is an undergraduate student at UW-Madison, member of the Wisconsin Student Climate Action Coalition, and served on the governor's climate change task force. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
You were the youngest member of the governor's climate change task force. What perspective did you bring to this work as a student and as an activist?
It was very tough at the beginning because I thought that in a room full of, I don't want to call them adults, but people more down the line, understanding, have done this for like many years, would have like turned me down. But I actually turned out to be very different because I naturally just like came about pointing out my views, pointing out how like a lot of like issues intersect, especially if you don't incorporate social justice. So like I was easily the one person normally people would go to like explain how like the community can get involved to, whether that is like planning wise, implementation and maintaining any policy or type of idea that we had brewing up.
As you look back at this work, what did you learn from those fellow colleagues, those other members of the task force? What sticks with you from them?
I learned so many things. I learned that first and foremost, people care. And as I mentioned earlier, like with climate anxiety, it's easy to forget that people, you know, may be doing this work and people do care. And like, this is some like people's professions for years. So I came out of it saying that like, all right, you know, slowly but surely we can start the conversation and actually get some goals and policy started, which gave me a lot of hope, even though it seemed very daunting at times.
I had to chuckle. I think I heard you say on one of these conference calls that you had ordered multiple copies of the governor's task force final report on climate change because you were so proud of that body of work and all the hours and labor that went into it. Do you see its directives and suggestions being executed and acted on?
Most certainly. Since the report has been released, a lot of like commentators, interviews have like pop up. Same with like legislators wanting to actually propose this and push through change through other legislators who want to sign, for instance, like a bill, stuff like that. And I was particularly very interested in being at UW-Madison as a student because often at times in my climate change courses, they would bring up the report and we were taught to read it and summarize it and discuss it in class. Yes. So my teacher.
This is when you should have just taken over the lecture, Stephanie.
Yes, very often my teacher assistants, my professors would notice that I was in the reports and I was part of the reports. So they would like ask me to go to the front and explain further about how the process was like. And so I feel like even if this report was not directly like, you know, being implemented right away, I did see a lot of conversations started, which gave me a lot of hope into making people realize that, like, one of the main things, for instance, of the report is to see social justice through the framework instead of like just a checkbox that you need to like fill in. So there was a lot of conversation starting how a lot of issues do intersect and climate change and the climate crisis will just worsen its consequences.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Stephanie Salgado, who's a college student, been working on climate issues. Join in on your priorities and the work you're doing to promote environmental sustainability. What you want to know about task force work in Wisconsin, what goes into it. Join in at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, the United Nations says there are 1.8 billion young people in the world between the ages of 10 to 24. It is the largest generation of youth in history. And the UN also says that young people are really scaling up their efforts and using their skills to accelerate climate action. Do you see that happening? You know, what does that look like, especially here in Wisconsin?
That is a very interesting topic, and thank you for bringing that up, because I have seen definitely a shift. I was so proud at times to be working with so many young people, and also the fact that a lot of young people saw it through like very multidisciplinary views. At UW-Madison particularly, our group of like students that came together to be part of the climate strike and be part of like CERN actions that we try to promote within decision makers at our college to take more sustainable policies. We're from all different majors, English, engineers. And so I just thought that was really well-rounded, and that gave us the opportunity to look through it through multiple lenses and bring about a diverse set of solutions that we could actually propose and move forward. And when you had mentioned 1.8 billion, my goodness. I love the idea that there can be so many possibilities, so many things that can happen for amazing young people who need to be like supported, need to be given the resources, the opportunities. And we do have the space for this, and we need to equitably support communities. So I really hope that that 1.8 billion sticks with people to know that it is the climate crisis, one of the biggest problems that we should be facing and considering when considering the next generation who 20 to 30 years here, I guess, in the United States, but also many other communities around the world are currently already dealing with it. And like how we mentioned, even the United States, even Wisconsin having certain things that have changed over the years, more polar vortex, more unprecedented tornadoes happening, unprecedented climate changes or weather changes. That's all very relevant to the same question about how we're going to mitigate these things and actually support the young people that are coming before us.
That makes me wonder, you hear about people being forced to flee their home or their country because of climate change, because of disaster, natural disasters. But I wonder, is climate change the driver, or is it poverty, or is it disease or violence or discrimination? Do you think the climate crisis is the ultimate driver of migration, of climate migration?
That's a very interesting question. I'm still trying to like fully understand. Me, myself, I am an immigrant from Honduras. I moved here 6 years ago, and that's the first step I took to understand, to be honest, climate change. When I first came to the United States, I had thought that Honduras was just like and located in a tropical area, so we were prone to like hurricanes and many other climate disasters, and as well as like a lot of bad leadership. And for that reason, we have a lot of like violence and criminal activity, and as well with extreme poverty, making it one of the poorest countries in Latin America. But I came to understand too that third world country and the people living in those third world countries are the most prone to the consequences of climate change. So while it may not be always throughout history, the first indicator of immigration for a lot of folks is definitely being a propeller that is just being magnified, even in a bigger scale for farmers in Latin America who cannot make their ends meet. They need food on the table, they need a shelter, they need to immigrate. For other people who already didn't have access to opportunities in their communities, in the neighborhoods, and now they have to resort to doing it through other methods of surviving. But on top of that, having to deal with hurricanes, having to deal with rains and stuff like that, and the fact that your government does not back you up and cannot provide aid for you makes it very of a hopeless process. So throughout my activism, I'm constantly trying to understand how third world country people and immigrants need to be heard as one of the main indicators of how this climate crisis cannot go, the conversation cannot go without understanding how undocumented people deserve respect and dignity. They deserve humanity, and no human is illegal.
Stephanie Salgado works on climate issues at the intersection of social justice and immigration. A younger voice who has had a seat at the table on climate committee work here in Wisconsin. Join in on how you see the climate policy taking shape in your community, activism that you've been a part of, or why you don't view yourself as an activist when it comes to this issue. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Stephanie Salgado here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about climate change in Wisconsin. What happens to committee work after major reports get published, recommendations get made? It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So a parallel to this, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change wraps up today in Bonn, Germany. At its opening press event last week, the UN Climate Change Executive Secretary Patricia Espinoza said, "The world wants an accounting for what has been done since the UN's climate change conference in November."
What have you done since Glasgow? Where is the progress? How can you demonstrate that we are on the right track?
Key prompts for discussion here at home as well. 800-642-1234. We have college student Stephanie Salgado served on the governor's task force on climate change with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff joining us from Delafield. Jeff, hi. What's coming up for you?
Yes, good morning. My comment is one of the things that really disappoints me about the climate change discussion is we never talk about the details and the impacts of what a zero carbon economy would mean. How many acres of our grasslands and forest lands and farmlands would have to be converted to be covered with glass panels for solar, and how many acres of wind turbines and the transmission lines that it would be required to get the power from the areas where those are, how many trees do we have to cut down for transmission lines? Nobody likes transmission lines. Nobody wants them. There's always a protest, but you can't have it both ways. And we never seem to have that discussion. What are the impacts? And why don't we talk more about nuclear power? The technology is driving that to the point where it seems to be much safer. There's ways to deal with the waste. Apparently, we can actually use the current waste stockpiles to generate energy. So I never hear those discussions, and yes, that's really disappointing to me.
Jeff, thank you so much for that comment. And what I'm hearing overarching there is that the conversations about climate, Stephanie, they need to be granular. Who's doing what and when? And there needs to be some accounting here.
Very true. Thank you again for your comment, because I know that at the climate change task group, we definitely addressed that. There's a lot of folks who propose different policies, and one of them being zero emissions. So there was a lot of conversations on how to do it, just like how you mentioned, like a just transition into understanding better how, like, we as a community can actually afford this. And for instance, acres of land and with different methods of solar and wind energy that we can actually implement especially in Wisconsin. So there's a lot of conversation about it, and there's some policies within the report that were taken out, unfortunately, because we didn't thought that Wisconsin was either that policy was going to not pass through the legislation, or that policy was not at, you know, the perfect conditions for Wisconsin to implement it. But I do encourage you to check out the report and call your local legislators and decision makers if you want to push forward some zero emissions policies, because that is a very important conversation that you pointed out.
Jeff, thanks for the call. You know, and it, I think it speaks to as well that there are so many moving pieces when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. Vern from Boyd called, couldn't stay with us. And Vern's biggest concerns with climate change are row crop farming and airplanes. Jeff brought up nuclear, transmission lines, so many other things. Stephanie, how do you integrate all that and especially then think about social justice and immigration and try to figure out where are the priorities? How do these all intersect?
That is very true and still a very tough decision-making skill set that a lot of climate activists have to juggle. Climate activists, climate advocates, climate informants is very difficult at times, because for the longest time we have known that the climate crisis has been ongoing, that the fossil fuel industry knew about the climate crisis and what they could cause and the consequences and continue going for it. So now that we have actually suffering the consequences and we're still going down the path utilizing fossil fuels instead of divesting, we are having to prioritize what actually can we move forward as a proposal, as a solution. So what I find hope in and what I find a lot of solutions to conversations is the past, is the history. So I know that I've read throughout my courses a lot of materials about Black and Indigenous leaders who have created this environmental movement way before it was called as such. It was the sustainable crop harvesting methods that a lot of Indigenous community now located in the United States, we're already practicing. It's a lot of the Black leaders and Black folks in their communities who advocated for not energy companies that were not taking into consideration the community needs, and instead they were polluting. Mm. So I do think that while there's a lot to figure out, there's a lot to also understand into what has been done in the past and what can we not make if it's a mistake again. And instead, as a community, and all the people be gathered together and work together towards a solution.
Stephanie Salgado with us, UW-Madison student activist concerned with environmental and immigration issues, working on them, discussing young people being valuable contributors to climate action, and taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Stephanie, if you imagine Wisconsin a decade from now, what does it look like? What will be different about the place we call home as this work continues?
I love that question. It gives me a lot of hope. I have been so fortunate to work with so many people from very diverse backgrounds into the climate crisis. For instance, a lot of farmers are truly concerned about the climate crisis, and very often we do not, you know, want to understand, or maybe not want, but instead we do not understand how farmers are actively being involved, how to sustainably harvest their crops, how to sustainably do their crops, and actually transport these to their communities to give them less mileage per food. I'm like thinking of the Wisconsin in 10 years being more productive, more sustainable, more actively of a member, of a leader for the world to see how sustainable farming does work, how sustainable farming can take us to the next level. And farming is such a big thing in Wisconsin. So I'm truly always trying to buy like local. And I know a lot of folks are very passionate about going to the farmers market. So I actively encourage people to continue doing that. Besides that, I also was fortunate enough to work with another young person who is a conservative person. Mm. And their whole organization was founded on the idea that conservative people can also care about climate change. And so while we do have very different views on the political spectrum, it was very interesting how we had agreed on the climate crisis. And that just gets to show that, like, through conversations, things can change and we can respect one another throughout it. So I just thought that was really interesting how those conversations can occur throughout Wisconsin if we're truly prepared to address one another respectfully.
Hmm. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Stephanie Salgado is a UW-Madison undergraduate student, member of the Wisconsin Student Climate Action Coalition, was the youngest member of the Wisconsin Governor's Climate Change Task Force. Ahead this hour, who will care for your pet if you take that summer vacation? A veterinarian fields your questions on pet boarding and pet sitting. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. A Minneapolis man pulled over in Wisconsin says police took nearly $10,000 from him, even though he was never charged with a crime. His case is an example of the burden that can fall on those who have cash, vehicles, or property seized by police. Despite a 2018 law intended to limit police's ability to seize assets from people who aren't convicted of crimes, the practice still happens. Rich Kramer reports.
Clifford Skinner's mom died in March. He wanted to help his father pay for the funeral, so he says he took $9,600 when he and his family drove from Minneapolis to Gary, Indiana. It was almost all the money he had, but Skinner says his father wouldn't take it. On the way home, Skinner was sleeping in the car when a Wisconsin State Trooper pulled his daughter over for speeding near Osseo.
He approached me and said that he smelled marijuana coming from the vehicle. I informed the state trooper that I am a medicinal cannabis user and my doctor prescribed me that as medication.
Skinner says the trooper took less than a quarter ounce of marijuana and seized all of the money. He received municipal citations but was never charged with a crime. Still, the state patrol wouldn't give Skinner's money back. The agency told WPR it wouldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. Skinner, who is black, says his money was referred to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency on suspicion it was tied to drug trafficking. He denies that.
Guilty until proven innocent. And that's basically where I'm sitting at right now. An innocent man that got robbed by the police and been unjustly done because of my skin complexion.
Skinner's fiance, Trina Lewis, says they were saving the money for a down payment on a future house. She wasn't there during the traffic stop, but says it traumatized five of their kids who waited in a squad car as the officer searched Skinner's van for more drugs to no avail.
You know, my kids, as we see the police driving down the street, taking them to daycare, they tense up. They get worried.
In 2018, a bipartisan group of Wisconsin legislators reformed state law aimed at preventing forfeitures from individuals unless they're convicted of a crime. But there are exceptions. Money or property referred to federal agencies like the DEA can be forfeited even if charges are never filed. And state or local law enforcement can keep proceeds from those forfeitures if a person is deported, flees the jurisdiction, or doesn't claim cash or property within 9 months. Dan Albin is the co-director of the National Initiative to End Forfeiture Abuse. He calls it policing for profit.
That, I think, is highly problematic when the federal government is encouraging state and local law enforcement to not comply with their very own state laws and instead simply participate in a federal program that allows them to sidestep or circumvent those protections.
At least half of any proceeds from state-level forfeitures must go to Wisconsin's school fund. But if a forfeiture goes federal, state and local law enforcement can keep all proceeds sent back by the U.S. Department of Justice following a conviction. In 2020, police in Wisconsin reported around $775,000 in cash and property forfeitures tied to convictions. That same year, the U.S. Department of Justice sent nearly $2 million in forfeited proceeds back to agencies in Wisconsin. Skinner suspects the State Patrol referred his money to the DEA in order to get a second opinion after the district attorney didn't file criminal charges. In Brown County, the sheriff's office received around $117,000 from the feds in 2020 for seizures it made. Lieutenant Matt Ronk is the director of the Brown County Drug Task Force. He says seizing assets is an important part of fighting criminal organizations, and he says his team isn't disproportionately seizing money during investigations.
But I also have a real problem leaving drug proceeds, illicit gains, predatory funds that were taken off of innocent people, innocent victims that either by force or by victimizing them with addiction.
As for Skinner, he's hired a lawyer at an estimated cost of $4,000 in hopes of getting his $9,600 back from the DEA. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now to leaving town and figuring out who will care for your pet. A shout out to Lisa in Milwaukee for inspiration on this segment. During our caller only hour this month, she was dropping off at doggy daycare when she called in, and it sounded like organized doggy chaos in the background. She wasn't calling about this topic, but you can see the germ of the idea. Bring your questions on pet boarding and pet sitting for the vet, 800-642-1234. Dr. Julia Bates is here, board-certified veterinarian in small animal internal medicine at Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. Dr. Bates, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Well, last we spoke was way back in 2020. It was about how the pandemic was really causing a lot of issues in veterinary care. What does that look like today?
I think things are improving. Things are settling down a little bit for veterinarians and for owners. Clinics are opening back up again. I travel around all over Dane County and Milwaukee County, and it's really variable from clinic to clinic. Some clinics are still doing a hybrid model where, you know, they're letting maybe some people come in, but most people are not coming into the clinic. Some clinics, it's kind of a free for all, you know, no masks, no nothing. So it's really interesting, the kind of the dichotomy from one clinic to the next. But I think all in all, things are, slowly getting back to the way they used to be.
Is there still such a backlog of trying to get into the vet? What about the number of vet techs? What about staffing?
Still problems. I mean, I think depending on where you are, a lot of clinics still have quite a bit of a backlog. Some clinics, their schedules have opened up and mm-hmm. they are, they have like surgeries and dentals, I think, are being pushed back quite a bit. But I think day-to-day appointments have been, getting in without too much of a problem.
Okay.
Staffing is still, it's still hard to find, good nursing staff. I mean, every clinic that I go into is looking for, someone. And, the nurses or the techs, they are really the backbone, along with the receptionists, are really the backbone of any practice. They're the ones that are, the first line. I mean, and the techs are doing so much of the communications and stuff with clients. And so they are really a valued part of the profession that's often overlooked.
Hmm. Well, here we go. Family going out of town, and that furry friend is going to get some boarding options. What do facilities require of a pet and the owner before an overnight stay?
Good question. It varies from boarding facility to facility, but mostly they do, most of them require some type of vaccinations, usually the core vaccinations such as distemper and rabies, and also Bordetella or the kennel cough vaccine. Hmm. Some clinics, when the flu virus, when influenza was kind of going around, influenza became part of their core requirements for vaccines. So some of them still require influenza. Those are the big things, essentially the Bordetella is probably the most important vaccine. But other core vaccines to help prevent, spread of disease.
So, and that Bordetella, that's to prevent what is called kennel cough from spreading. Is that right?
Correct. Correct. Kennel cough is a highly contagious. It's a constellation of bacteria and viruses, and it's really contagious. And dogs develop this, in most cases, a self-limiting, really loud, harsh cough. Mm. But in some cases, it can progress to become a pretty severe pneumonia.
So should I ask for a kennel tour? How should I pick out a boarding facility?
Great question. I think, yes, it's just like, it's like picking out your family veterinarian, right? Like I encourage people to go and visit, harder now with the pandemic, right? But to go and visit and walk around and make sure that you feel comfortable with where you're leaving them, you know, meet the staff, see what the kennel facilities are like. I think, you know, doing a meet and greet is super important and super helpful to set expectations. And so, you know, you have an idea of where your pet is staying while you're gone.
What should I look for in like the common play area, the dog hangout areas, because that's become really popular, that, you know, once upon a time, you know, dogs were put in isolation, but now there's these like play areas, and what should we look for there?
Well, is it clean? Does it smell like feces and urine? How are the dogs interacting with each other? Are there dogs that are really aggressive versus, you know, dogs that are really timid? What's the staff doing with the interaction? Are they, you know, left for just a free for all, or is there oversight in those open, you know, play areas?
Mm-hmm. What if your dog doesn't get along with other dogs, and if, you know, it doesn't do well in that group play setting? What are your options there?
Oh, there, you know, there's such a variety of kennels and boarding situations that, you know, some boarding facilities have, you know, really separated off place where they can have their own indoor outdoor sort of facilities. Some also have more separated areas where, you know, for additional fees, they almost have a wing or an area of the facility to themselves, and maybe a staff member will be there with them all the time, you know. Or, you know, if your dog is really shy and doesn't do well in group settings or in new places, you know, then having a pet sitter come in, you know, and take care of your pet in your home is a great option as well.
We're going to talk about pet sitting in a moment and what to look for there in preparing the pet sitter. But, you know, you mentioned cost, and how should you weigh the cost of boarding? Because, you know, it can add up really, those costs can add up quickly, and then there are extra fees usually.
Right. Those costs do add up quickly, and especially the more pets you have, right? The more expensive it gets. If there are multiple pets staying in the same kennel, I think there are somewhat discounts for that. You know, and it's tough because it's expensive, but they are providing, you know, a necessary care. And as we know, finding good staff is difficult. So it's that, you know, it's benefits versus, you know, cost essentially. You know, I mean, in a good place to let you feel comfortable leaving your dog where, you know, they're happy to go and well cared for, you know, is well worth its price in gold.
If your pet hasn't been boarded before, what are some ways that you can get them ready? How do you acclimate them to that environment ahead of time?
That's a great question. One of the best ways to do that would be if the facility has like a doggy daycare, mm-hmm. you know, taking them in with you for the visit of the clinic. How do they respond? Do they have a doggy daycare where they can, you know, go a couple of times before you're going out of town to see how they adjust? I think those are the best ways to try to get a good idea of how well they'll fit in.
Wisconsin veterinarian Julia Bates stays with us on how to think about pet care when we cannot take our furry family members with us when we leave town. Still time for your questions. What arrangements have worked for you in the past or didn't go well for caretaking or boarding? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Bates here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Taking our cat with us when traveling is not possible, and Maddie would not appreciate the journey given her track record for driving from Louisiana to Wisconsin. Goodness. So we want to leave her at home, but that requires advanced planning with a pet sitter. Join in on pet boarding, kennels, pet sitting tips, kennel resorts, what to expect, 800-642-1234. Dr. Julia Bates is a veterinarian with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Julie now in Cedarburg. Julie, hi.
Hi. Our family treats dog sitting. Our son and daughter-in-law have two dogs. The most recent one is a pit bull mix. It's a rescue, and that knows us well. We gave her a lot of exercise, but to be cautious, we had her sleep in the kitchen, which is good because she had diarrhea. And then again the next night, this is tough. And we're wondering if there's any kind of anti-anxiety medication or something they can give her in advance. We don't want to drug the dog, but that was difficult.
Julie, great question. Dr. Bates.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Julie. That is a great question, and not fun to either come home to or have the pet sitter have to deal with. And those are tough if there's a lot of anxiety and stress. There are a couple of ways to potentially manage that, and one would be to have more interactions with the pet sitter, whoever's coming in, going, and taking care of them, so they become more familiar, so it's less of a stressful event, and less having to worry about, drugging the dog. Otherwise, potentially talking to your veterinarian about maybe even having, starting the dog on a bland diet before you go out of town. That's kind of a low fat diet that will be less taxing on their GI tract, as well as maybe some medications or probiotics to have on hand in case it happens. And if all else fails, then, perhaps some anti-anxiety medications, a couple of days before you're going and while you're gone to kind of decrease that stress. But I think the ideal thing would be to try to do more of a, what can we do to make this a less, a more of a regular and less stressful kind of exciting event for them.
Yes, because, with pet sitting, your pet is still alone for long hours of the day and night. And I just wonder how much does that negate the advantage of keeping them in their familiar surroundings?
That's a great question. And I guess it depends on how long the owners are gone for the day.
Mm-hmm.
If the family is gone, 8 hours a day, then that's probably something that they're used to. And oftentimes pet sitters may come in more than, a couple times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people have dog walkers that come and walk their dog when they're gone, for long periods during the day. But I still think that if the dog is too stressed to go to a kennel, being in that home environment, or they're, old elderly pets, probably do a lot better in their home environment, where they know where things are and they have that comfort of being in their own place. So I think, both have their merits in, mm-hmm. in each situation.
My colleague Courtney chimed in here, and she has two adorable dogs. And, talking about pet sitting, there are apps like Rover to match a pet owner's needs with nearby sitters. And Courtney actually just booked their first one for next weekend. How should pet owners approach finding the right person over the internet if friends or family can't watch your pet?
Good question. One option to beyond those, I'm not too familiar about the, I've heard of the Rover app, but I'm not intimately familiar with that. So you have to forgive me. But I think, just like a kennel, interviewing them, having them come and meet your dog and meet your family and see how well you connect with them. Mm-hmm. Also talk to your veterinarian or your veterinary nursing staff. Do they have recommendations? A lot of techs to make some extra money will do pet sitting and house sitting. And they also, are great. They are great, especially if your pet needs medications. I mean, that's another big question to ask. If boarding or having a pet sitter come in, how can they handle administering medications. I mean, that's something that I hear a lot. People will go out of town and, you know, when we talk about what medications their pets need to be on, and it becomes overwhelming because they say, how am I going to get somebody else to do this? So how comfortable do they feel giving those medications and ensuring that they get them? But I think having that one-on-one connection and meeting them and make sure that you feel comfortable with them is probably the most important advice I could give.
My daughter does pet sitting, and one thing that we really appreciate is when the owner writes out exactly everything, like every, you know, just every amount, every how the day is structured, and just so it's all there in one place, written out, even though we've gone over it and done the walkthrough. Just having those instructions is really handy. Are there any thoughts on that?
I think that's a great idea. When I leave town, I write out descriptions of my pets, even though the people that have taken care of them know them, you know, with their names. And, you know, Emmy, she's the striped cat, and Millie, the boxer, and kind of their ages, and any when they get fed and how much they get fed and where they get fed. Yes, I think that's really important. And that way there's no confusion, right? Like the you're coming in and there's all the excitement and you know, it's easy to forget what might happen and when it's supposed to happen. So having it written out very well is important, especially if they are on any medications. That is really important too. I reached out to local people in my community to see if they had any advice too. For boarding, and one of the really good comments that I got was that owners should really be able to, should really communicate well any medications that their pet is on, and that's in a boarding facility or at home, and have it, you know, well outlined what they get, when they get it, how they get it, and then also to have things labeled very well. You know, it's if you're, even if you're pet sitting and you go into home and there's a bottle of pills, but they're not well labeled, it's can be overwhelming, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we're getting pets the right medication. So having, you know, having that written down and having things labeled very well would be really helpful for everyone.
Dr. Bates, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Julia Bates is with Madison Mobile Veterinary Specialists. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.